Hi friends, new and regular listeners. This is Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren and we are coming to you from Göteborg in Sweden. It's good to have you all with us today, and I hope you are comfortable wherever you are and ready for another interesting radio program. The website is redicecreations.com. Go there to see, hear, and read much more. Check through our free radio archive and check out our members area as well if you want to expand your horizon even more. And today we have Nick Rosen with us on the line from the UK. He's the author of How to Live Off-Grid. He's a freelance journalist. He's written for The Times and other publication, and he is behind the website off-grid.net. That's the place to go to find articles, more information about his book, and other resources on how to get off the grid. A while back, I read an article by Nick titled Living Off the Grid, How to Escape the Spies All Around Us. And he joins us today on the program to talk about this, his research, and the website. So with that, welcome to Red Ice Radio, Nick, and thank you for taking your time in your busy schedule to talk with us today.
Nice. Thank you very much for inviting me.
We only have about 1 hour today here, so I suggest we dive right into it. But before we talk about how to get off the grid, Nick, maybe we could just spend a little bit of time on defining what you mean by the grid and primarily why you wanted to find a way out of it.
Sure. Well, for me, the grid is both a factual matter and also a metaphorical matter. So there's the basic grid that defines our world of electricity lines and motorways and water lines and sewage and possibly phone as well. And then there's a more metaphorical grid, which is to do with supermarket distribution patterns and garages that sell gas and banks and just mainstream society in general. And that's a much more metaphorical kind of a grid. And I'm not suggesting that many of us can escape all the grids all the time. I think all we can hope to do is minimize our life on the grid and in some cases, you know, reduce it very heavily. But for most of us, especially living in the city, it would be pretty difficult to eliminate the grid altogether.
And why did you kind of want to get off the grid to begin with? If I ask you, like, what was the tipping point for you? We have so many things going on, not only what you mentioned here, but we have snooping. You guys over there in the UK, you have the most CCTV cameras, for instance, of all the countries in the world, it seems like right now. The Big Brother system is widely expanded over there. Was this an issue for you? Was that something you were concerned about and wanted to get out of that as well?
Yeah, we do have millions of CCTV cameras all recording our every move, although and the information that they record is completely unregulated. But no, that wasn't the only reason for me. And I think for most people, for everybody, there's a whole bunch of different reasons that all play into each other. And for one person, one reason is more important. For one other people, a different reason. And it's everything from the intrusive power of the state to the way that the state has now become the banker's support mechanism. And I think so many people are now completely disgusted with modern society because it's supporting the bankers but letting ordinary people have their houses taken away. So I think for a lot of people, it's to do with money. It's to do with the grid system. It's just very expensive, and you spend a long time in your working day. A large percentage of your working day is spent paying the mortgage, paying the electricity bill, paying the water bill, paying the supermarket bill. And we all know at the back of our minds, or possibly at the front of our minds, that if we eliminated all those bills, we'd only have to work a very small number of hours per day. And the life we're living isn't making us happy and isn't giving us privacy, and we're kind of questioning why we're doing it. But most of us feel like we're trapped in it, or we can't make the decisions we need to make to get out of it. So what we try and do is remove ourselves at least as much as possible. And perhaps for a lot of people, that's an ongoing process of gradually removing ourselves.
Yes, absolutely. And would you say that it's becoming more and more easy to do that because we do have access to new technologies. Alternatives are beginning to pop up here and there. But at the same time, it seems to me that the hand of the system that you're describing is also getting tighter and tighter, so to speak. We not only have the surveillance cameras to worry about in that sense. If we look at the online world, we have Facebook, Twitter, and Google. All is kind of spying on us and collecting data on us, as it were.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was writing my book, How to Live Off-Grid, which is just about my trip around Britain, I went around Britain in an RV, a camper van, which had a solar panel and a few batteries. Well, of course, just traveling in a vehicle with a registration plate, I was already part of the system. I'm insured. I've got a driving license. I have to buy gas, although I did buy a lot of my fuel came from supermarkets in the form of vegetable oil for my diesel truck, and I can pay cash for that, and I can earn that cash by working casually or growing things and selling them in markets. And in America, there's especially in Northern California, there's a lot of people growing products for cash up in Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are ways of sort of at least semi-removing yourself. In Britain, there's a big horse-drawn community, they call themselves, and they live in caravans which are drawn by horses, mainly in the southwest of England, and they don't have to have any vehicle registration, and they don't have any insurance, they don't have any identity cards of any sort, they're not claiming anything from the state. And they're living good lives in small communities, in fields they may have bought or inherited. If you own land that wasn't bought within the last 60 years, that land won't even be registered on the central land registry. It could have been inherited or just land that you squatted on or common land. And so it is possible on the margins to live completely outside of the system. But as I said earlier, for most of us, that's not possible. But if we want to use the technology to kind of get away from it and yet be there in the city even when you're in the country, it is possible to do that with a certain degree of anonymity and privacy. So, for example, you can buy pay-as-you-go phones, or prepay, they're called in the States. And, of course, you could pay with a credit card for that, or you could pay cash, or you could have somebody else go in and buy it for you. And then their face will be on the CCTV camera. And if you're really conscientious and thorough about it, you could have a homeless person go in and buy it for you. And you could be waiting around the corner with the other half of the cash for them when they complete the assignment. So that's your phone. A similar thing can be done with your prepay mobile internet. It's a little stick that you plug into your laptop. And again, you can just buy that and you can charge it up when you need to using cash or possibly using somebody else's credit card if you've got someone. And you can constantly be kind of swapping and changing credit cards. And, you know, there are things like store loyalty cards which give you discounts and cash back. But you can swap those store loyalty cards with friends so that the store isn't tracking your particular habits anymore. You know, you've got the card, and once you've kind of used up all the credit on it, you swap it with a friend who's also got a card. So there are ways to just outsmart, you know, the big computer systems which are watching us all the time, and retain our privacy, and through that, in a way, our dignity and our sense of pride in ourselves.
Absolutely. And what do you think is the most worrying in terms of, if we look at it from the surveillance point of view, is it where the data is going, or do you think that there is, how should I put it, kind of active spying going on? To me, it seems like they're more interested in collecting data for the demographic use, so to speak.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a major industry now which is selling that data, both data in terms of they collect it all on us and then they analyze it. And it's anonymous data, but there's also a pretty big industry selling personal data. To me, the most worrying, you can divide it up into government and corporate. data. And the government holds a lot of information about us, and corporations hold a lot of information about us. And to me, in both cases, the most worrying thing is incompetence, stupidity. You know, we're told, don't worry, we're looking after you, it's going to be fine, but it's not fine at all. So the government is constantly losing data, and there are forever major security lapses in everything from, you know, your medical records to your tax records to the details of which are held about government's own employees or the army's employees. This information is constantly leaking out to either commercial information organizations or to criminals or to just journalists and the public. So the first thing is that governments and companies cannot be relied upon to safeguard our data. Mm. You know, there's a very well-known case in Europe of a woman who was divorced, and she wanted to hide her new address from her husband, but he rang her insurance company and was given it. So there's just nothing like enough safeguards, and the companies themselves lobby vigorously against these safeguards being put in place because they say it would increase their costs. But I find most disappointing at the moment is we don't seem to be entering a time of huge skepticism against the corporates. It wouldn't be true to say we've forgotten about the bankers and their bonuses, but we don't seem to be doing anything about it.
Yeah.
And that really upsets me. And I think that's driving a lot of people off grid because they just have lost faith in the ability of the system to look after them. And so, for example, when it comes to lobbying from power companies about information or about the price of energy, they just seem to get away with it time after time, and they are allowed to keep their profits, when in fact it would be perfectly possible to say, well, sorry, but until you've done the job you need to do with your public utility that you own, until you're providing energy at an affordable price and safeguarding our information, you can just go without profits, mate.
That's right.
But nobody seems to be able to screw up the courage to confront these corporations.
That's right. And even though there are internal reports coming out on, for instance, the issue of CCT cameras over in the UK, a recent report claimed that actually it doesn't solve crime. And that was a warning that came from the head of the Visual Images Identifications and Detections Office at the New Scotland Yard not that long ago. And although people from within the system are saying that it doesn't really help, I wonder, where's the question about, well, what do we have it for then? What's the purpose for it? But that doesn't seem to be happening. Why do you think that is, Nick?
Well, CCTV cameras were kind of set up without any kind of massive plan. And the reason it's happening, the factual answer is because cameras don't stop crime, they move crime to places where there are no cameras.
That's right.
And so maybe somebody thought, well, listen, if we have millions of cameras, there'll be nowhere for the criminals to go. But of course, that ain't true, because you'd have to have 10 times or 100 times the number of cameras to cover absolutely everywhere. And then we really would be living in the world of, you know, if Truman's world of that Jim Carrey film a few years ago.
Yes.
So the first thing is cameras don't stop crime, they move it. The second thing is that once a crime has been committed, it has to be quite a serious crime before the police are willing to go to the trouble of looking at the cameras, because it's a very time-consuming thing. So when there's a terrorist act, of course, they get all the cameras and they have a vast army of people whose job is just to look at video and try and pick out, try and follow cars or follow individuals through different video cameras. But even when they do decide that the crime is serious enough to warrant getting hold of the video, there's another problem, because all of these cameras are all running on different standards with different kinds of film, and there's no regulation saying that they have to be handed in, and nobody is in charge of licensing them in any way. So they've got another problem, which is that they might go to a particular camera and find it wasn't working that day, or that the film has been overwritten because that was 3 days ago and they just, you know, keep overwriting it every 24 hours. So the whole thing's a pointless mess. And, you know, in a way that is our salvation because, you know, it is, the system isn't working terribly efficiently.
Well, that's true. And the question is that, I wonder if they're putting that out there as a kind of a problem to bring in the solution, so to speak, later on, because I'm wondering what the extension of this system would be if it's allowed to run its course. We're talking about everything from intelligent buildings, as they call it, RFID tags with data feedback in everything, and with biometrical scans even in the floor plan of the building, so it can sense who it is that's walking on the floor inside the building. I mean, how far do you think they can go in terms of this total surveillance grid that seems to be popping up all around us?
As far as we'll let them is the answer.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, if you want my prediction, I think that there is a major change of attitude coming down the way, but it's not here yet. But what's going to happen, unfortunately, in Europe and America is there's going to continue to be an increase in unemployment, certainly in Britain and America. I can't be quite so sure about the rest of Europe because I'm not an expert on that. But in Britain, I know that the public sector is going to have to be cut very sharply over the next few months to pay for the huge bank bailout.
Mm.
And there'll be a huge increase in unemployment, and especially in unemployment among recent university graduates, because there's been a vast boom in university going among that age group. And so we're going to end up with a whole generation who can't get work or can't get proper work in a year's time or two. And those people are going to become very anti-corporate. And I look to them as being the generation that might finally kind of provide the popular will to take on the corporations and the information society, because it's not coming from those who have jobs and have houses. They're very happy to just continue to exist in the consumer world.
So if we talk a little bit about what the purpose ultimately is for all the snooping and things that we're talking about so far, do you think it is to control human beings ultimately, or is it an honest attempt here to keep us safe, so to speak, or is that the guise that they try to bring in the system under? What do you think, Nick?
Well, this kind of gets back to the earlier question about what are the biggest threats from the information society, and I said that the biggest threat was incompetence, and however, there are many other threats, and possibly the second biggest threat is not from the corporations, but it is from government, because we kind of assume that our governments on the whole are going to be largely well disposed towards the citizens. But of course that can change, and it has changed in history, and it's never more likely to change than when there's a major crisis, whether that's caused by climate change and global warming, or whether it's caused by economic collapse and fighting on the streets. And that is when the government's control over our information could suddenly become a real menace. And so the Facebook generation is very happy to kind of go giving its information out online and doesn't really worry about privacy in the way that the older generations that went through the Second World War and communism and Nazism are much more suspicious about handing out information. And so there could be a shock down the line from government if and when we hit really turbulent times. And then the third and possibly most current risk from information is from the corporations, who are using it to sell to us, to predict our every move, and also, of course, to chase us down when we owe them money. So at the moment, if you have an argument with a company about some product or service that you feel wasn't delivered properly, you know, you have the right to withhold payment, let's say. So you withhold payment, but whereas before they might just give up on you because it just wouldn't be worth chasing, there's now a vast information network that can keep punishing you for that for the rest of your life. It'll be on a record somewhere, and the next time you apply for credit or the next time you want to open an account with a phone company, that's held against you, or when you want a mortgage, it's held against you. So the power of the people who control the information networks to punish you for what they consider to be misbehavior is one of the things I find most offensive.
Mm.
But a lot of people have lost their credit ratings as a result, and as a, you know, and then their homes, and that is a, in America especially, is a common enough story.
Yes, absolutely. And so I guess what you're saying as well then is that this move towards the cashless society is also incorporated into this the fear, so to speak, that you're describing here. That's also a big threat, so to speak, to our privacy, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and the question is also as well if there's a way to, and you alluded to this a little bit earlier or touched upon this, if there's a way to live within the grid but to remain more anonymous. I mean, how can we hide from CCT cameras, for instance, by not being too, you know, standing out too much by having a ski mask overhead or something like that? You know what I mean?
Sure. And there's a whole bunch of tips. I think if you go on the off-grid website, you'll find a list of them somewhere, ways to thwart Big Brother, I think it's called, which includes, well, with the CCTV cameras, wear a hat. I mean, hats have really gone out of fashion. If you look at pictures of crowds 50 years ago, everybody was wearing a hat. But, of course, hats fall off when you run, and they're not part of the, you know, the sort of active sportswear age we live in. But hoodies are. So for the fashionably inclined, wear a hoodie and keep your eyes, you know, out of sight of the CCTV cameras. And for those older people who are worried about privacy, wear a hat with a nice wide brim, and then the CCTV cameras won't be able to identify you, because one of the few rules that the CCTV cameras have to follow is they have to be above 2 meters above the ground. That's just a health and safety regulation they have to follow.
Hmm.
So wear a hat and they won't be able to detect your facial features. And then the other thing that's happening with the CCTV cameras is that all the traffic cameras are hooked into the National Police computer. And by the way, the CIA now has access to all that data. So if you think of that movie, The Bourne Identity, it's not fanciful to think that the CIA could be tracking Jason Bourne via CCTV traffic cameras in Britain. The British Home Secretary specifically gave permission for that very thing to happen in a, you know, a little noticed order a couple of years ago. When it comes to driving around, when your car, you know, your car registration number is on a computer, and that means that anytime you pass a traffic camera, the number is automatically recognized, and you are automatically being tracked from that moment on. So one solution that some people adopt is simply not to drive around in cities where most of these cameras exist. And if you do, then maybe rent a car or borrow a friend's car. There is a small way that you can deter the video cameras, especially at night. You can have an infrared light in the light bulb that shines onto your registration number, your car registration number, and that will completely confuse existing video camera technology.
Is that illegal, or is that?
It's not illegal, no.
Mm. Well,
because it's not something that's yet been made illegal.
That's a very good tip, Nick. And you know, I'm also wondering a little bit about the, because you mentioned the corporate world, and then we have the government on top of that. But what about this public-private partnership that we see developing now as well, where we have private companies that are kind of under contract by government? For instance, we can mention the Axiom Corporation. Like, it's been described as one of the biggest companies that you've never heard of, and that are primarily involved in analyzing computer data, information technology, data mining, and so forth, which gather all of this data. It's a private company, but the governments can use that. Have you heard about Axiom, by the way?
Yeah, and also there's another company called Serco, in Britain, which in Europe, which handles a lot of functions that you would think governments would be in charge of, like everything from traffic lights to CCTV cameras.
Mm.
So what about them? Well, they should be more effectively regulated, and what they do with their information should be very transparent. And there should be very specific legislation to say what they cannot do with their information, you know, as to exactly how it has to be held, what level of security there has to be on it, what punishments they face if they lose any of the information, and in particular, what restrictions there are on mining that information.
Exactly. And, you know, if we start to get into a little bit of the, I guess, the solutions of what can be done, or rather how to get off grid, you know, keeping yourself off the grid seems to become almost like a full-time job as well, in one sense. It's a more and more difficult, so to speak, in that sense. And do you think that that could be one of the purposes as well, that they slowly, get you so tired that you become acclimatized to the situation that you're in, that it becomes so difficult to remain anonymous within the system, so eventually you kind of accept it? Do you think that's could be the case here as well?
I think that for a lot of people, they're actually quite pleased to, you know, have the information network around them. I think for a lot of people, it makes them feel safe. And I think that was one of the messages of George Orwell's book 1984, that it's only a minority of people who worry about these things. Obviously, there's criminals who worry about it, but leaving criminals out of the equation for the moment, there's people who care about their freedom and their ability to be free-willed, independent citizens. And then there's people who are actually quite happy to be consumers, who just, you know, want to be left alone to consume and don't really care who's collecting any information about them until it's too late, you know.
Yeah.
And so we mustn't for a moment think that we're fighting on behalf of everybody. But for the minority of us who want our freedom and don't want to be become a trapped consumer who's simply kind of servicing the corporate monolith, there are a very wide number of choices as to how we can live our life. And that includes, you know, being off-grid in the city. You can still be right in the middle of town and have, in some cases, you know, renewable energy, whether that's from solar panels or from a wood-burning stove. And you'll certainly have to reduce your energy consumption. And you can catch your own water from the rain. And, you know, this might sound kind of, you know, fanciful or Luddite, but it's not. I mean, the technology is now good enough that you can do it and live that way. And, you know, obviously it requires an upfront investment, but the result is that you're no longer dependent upon the energy company to provide your power.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, they might not always be able to do.
Well, exactly. Very good point, Nick. I was just going to ask you about that, because how can we, we don't really have any guarantee that it always will be in place. And if we have potential, you know, changes going on in terms of either everything from sun activity pretty much up to flooding or change in weather patterns, these kinds of services can be knocked out as well, and we stand there not having any alternatives, so to speak. So to be independent, so to speak, from that, it's a very good idea, don't you say?
It's getting to be a better and better idea, and there's two things happening. One is, in Europe and in America, there's a realization that there's a huge investment needed in order to cater for the coming electricity demand. That we've got aging plants which are going to be taken out of service for one reason or another, and that we haven't invested early enough in their replacements. That's true in some countries, but not in others. It's not true in Germany. It is true in Britain. It's true in America. I don't know about Eastern Europe. And so that's the first thing, is that for various political reasons, a lot of it to do with the nuclear power debate, the governments haven't invested or haven't allowed investment to take place early enough. And so there is a chance the lights will go out for that reason. Then there are the geopolitical issues like Russian gas, which could be cut off at any time. And in fact, the Russians did recently announce they're going to start turning the gas off to the Ukraine again. And then there's the whole issue of peak oil, which is still slightly an open question. But, you know, the whole question of whether we want to be dependent on the Middle East for oil, which in any case we know is damaging the environment. So there are those issues, those sort of geopolitical issues about who's going to supply us with our energy. There's the issue of the fact that we're polluting every time we use that energy. There's the cost of that energy. There's the fact that that energy used to be owned publicly, largely by public corporations that operated for the general good, but is now largely owned by private corporations, yeah, which are operating purely to return a profit to their shareholders.
Yeah.
So for each of those reasons, an individual might decide that it'd be better off if they were supplying their own energy. And also in each of those reasons, especially for environmental reasons, but also for all the other reasons, look at ways of reducing our energy consumption. There's a chapter in my book about the early days of the grid, of why the grid was built in the first place. And what I was very interested to discover when I did the historical research was that our vast energy consumption in our homes was fostered and created and encouraged by, of course, the energy companies.
Yeah.
It was the energy companies that sold us fridges and cookers. It was the energy companies decided that they didn't need to be terribly efficient. It was the energy companies that taught us that central heating was a good thing, that we ought to be able to stroll through our homes, wearing a T-shirt in the coldest days of the year. Whereas only less than a century ago, we would expect to have one room warm and wear warm clothes in winter, which is surely a more natural way of doing things. So this vast energy industry is exploiting us by having lulled us all through very effective advertising, by the way, into thinking that we ought to be spending huge amounts more on energy than we actually need to.
A very good point. And if we continue on that thread, Nick, in terms of solar panels, installations of those, as far as I try to keep an eye on this as much as I can as well, but there are seems to be coming out new brands and new kind of models, updated versions, which seems to be better and better all the time. Do you guys over at the website keep a good eye on this as well, and how to go about what to buy and what not to get, and how to install and things like this?
We do, and it is a constantly changing scenario, and also it does depend very, very much on an individual circumstances. But I think the best general advice I'd give people is to try not to do it on a single household level. So if you live in a street, then try and get the street to buy a bigger wind turbine, because bigger wind turbines are much more effective, more easy to maintain. They break down less because they've got a lot of moving parts. And if you live in a block of flats, instead of letting your organic waste, like your sewage and your vegetable waste, just go be taken away by the sewage company and the dustman, then in a block of flats, you could build something called an anaerobic digester in the basement. And all the toilets could go down to the basement, and you could produce from that all the gas you need for all the energy you need. That's what happens in every village in China. There are 34 million of those anaerobic digesters, local ones at village level.
Mm.
And we could have them here. We could have them in Europe. We could have them in America. And it would just be a question of the regulations being adapted and of course, an industry springing up to service it. At the moment, of course, there isn't a company that would be able to install 34 million anaerobic digesters. If anybody would like to get together with me to start such a company, then please do get in touch.
Hmm.
I should say that I've got a book coming out in America next year called Off Grid America,
mm-hmm.
which is the results of my trips around America this year, and I'm still finishing it. It's going to be published by Penguin. And I very much hope that when I launch that book, it'll also be at the same time launching an off-grid power company, which will start supplying power to communities in that way. And I want the communities to own their own power. So, you know, there are a lot of companies at the moment which are making large sums of money by installing power, you know, renewable energy, taking advantage of people's goodwill towards green things, and then just simply charging the same as the utility company. But the business model which I would like to see happen is that communities own their own power. And my company's job would simply be to facilitate that, would be to kind of negotiate on their behalf with the wind turbine company and the local electricity company, because, of course, they still own the actual network into each home, and there's no reason to build another one, and to sort of produce a fair business deal by which the local community gets its electricity for free and sells any surplus back, and the electricity company gets a fair price for any electricity that's still needed.
So what you're talking about pretty much here is more independent cells, so to speak, within cities as well, which means that every little part takes care of itself at first hand, but then if there's any surplus, as you say, this could be routed elsewhere and helped other cells around
exactly.
the city, you know,
so,
to take care.
It's a bit like the internet for power.
Yeah.
And it'd be silly to kind of cut off from the grid, but at the same time, the grid might end up withering away because there'd be much less need for it.
Yeah.
So at times of peak energy, that's when the grid might still be needed. At times of peak energy consumption, which is to say, during the World Cup, during the advertising break of the World Cup in midwinter, you'd certainly still need the grid.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not
a lot
about
of time, local power could be produced that would satisfy local demand, and if there was any surplus, it could be routed to the next door location. It wouldn't necessarily have to go back into the grid.
Right, right.
Or it could be stored in hydrogen tanks or various other means of storage.
So I did want to ask you a little bit later here in terms of the Off-Grid America, the new book you have, and the previous book, which seems to be more maybe UK-based and what the differences are, but if we just quickly look at the term of like green labeling, for instance, or something being organic is kind of, well, it's hip now in one way. Just as long as you put a green stamp on something, it's okay and we go ahead. But the question is there, of course, are we getting the real thing, so to speak? Is there a danger here as well that we might end up in a position that as long as we see an approved stamp on something which has a green color to it, we automatically think, oh, okay, it's better, I'm doing something for, improvement of the world or whatever, and we move on without thinking more about it. What do you think, Nick?
Yeah, well, the first problem is that manufacturers have realized that there's a big price premium for a green stamp, and the first question you have to ask yourself is it really green at all? I mean, there have been loads of successful prosecutions by now for a product which calls itself organic and isn't.
Yeah.
And so the first question is, how do you know for sure that this is an organic product? And then the second question is if you're not talking about things like food or vegetables, the second question is, although it might be a bit more green in some ways, what about the entire production chain? If you take a product like Ecova, for example, which is a so-called ecological washing powder and a range of washing up liquids, well, when that started, that was a fantastic company that was all operated out of one small production unit in the London area. But now it's owned by Procter & Gamble, and it's just part of a vast multinational, and it's their green brand. And it's no longer obvious that that brand is green from start to finish. It may be that its product is slightly less harmful for the environment, but what about the vast trucks that deliver it around the country? What about the packaging? What about the advertising? So in a way, it's hardly any greener than any other product.
Hmm. Yep. That's something to definitely consider. And what about if we look at, money systems, alternative to that? There's alternative currencies out there as well, something called the LETs that you probably have heard about. Is that something that you feel is a good idea? Could that really...
Yeah, it's a very good idea because it's, again, about bringing power back to communities.
Yeah.
And also about communities establishing their identities, because we hear repeatedly, and I think it's true, that communities are dying in the modern consumer world, where everything is, where the corporations prefer everything to be like every other community, and every shopfront to be like the shopfronts in all the other communities. So having your own community currency can be quite a powerful way of keeping work and keeping product local. And I've looked at lots of different examples of it. And it does have to be quite local, because it's about trust, in the same way that, you know, you accept pound notes or euros because you trust they're going to be worth the same tomorrow. There has to be this level of trust in a local currency that you are going to be able to spend it tomorrow. And normally local currencies work in conjunction with local barter organizations. So you might barter your time with somebody else, you know, and do some babysitting in return for some mending or whatever it might be.
Yes.
And then you get paid in these tokens or local currencies, but which you can also spend in local stores, but stores that provide local product, whether that's locally grown food or locally made craft objects. But where it's stuff that nobody at any point had to pay, take credit for or pay normal money for, then local currencies can work really well.
You know, one thing I want to ask you, Nick, is in regards to this idea of what happened when you looked at off-grid America. The U.S. is a big country, so they have colder climates there, of course, as well. But, you know, we here up in the north, we have a little bit different situation, because during wintertime, it's more difficult to keep the house warm and all this stuff. Do you think that there's a huge difference that, for instance, people who live more south will have an easier time to be off-grid than we might have up here in the north? What's your take on that, Nick?
I think it is easier in the south, and that's why America's population is trending towards the southwest. But I still also, and by the way, my next project is off-grid Europe, but I haven't started that one yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I did come across many, many very successful off-grid communities and individual houses in the northeast of America, right up in the snow belt, using natural resources, i.e. wood, for heat, but also using things like ground source heat pumps, and also using good old-fashioned architectural techniques so that the heat very doesn't really vary. If you have very, very thick walls and the right kind of architecture, then your heat is never going to fall much below 50 degrees anyway.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, there's different ways you can go about in order to, as you say, keep the heat inside the house. So, for instance, everything you have, appliances and so forth, helps to contribute to the heating of the house, your computer, your television, whatever it is that you have going. And why do you think that it is that we haven't implemented this yet? Is that by the same hand of propaganda, if you will, that has also tried to get us dependent on the electricity, on the power company, so to speak?
Very much so, yeah. In other words, housing design and heating design was very much developed with in the era of ultra-cheap energy, you know, where we, the West, you know, America, and Western Europe were the kind of main consumers of energy by a very, very long, long way. So we were really able to just take it at far less than it was worth from the rest of the world, and it didn't really matter how wasteful we were. But what's changed now is not so much peak oil that people talk about. It's simply that the rate at which we're extracting it from the earth is no longer keeping up with demand from the newly emerging countries of China and India.
That's right.
And that is the reason why energy prices are going up, and that is the reason why these old technologies are suddenly in vogue again. Because it's just simply a question of ancient wisdom from the days before it was possible to extract oil from the ground. But these days we can combine that ancient wisdom with new technology in the form of, for example, solar panels, or in the form of, you know, wireless internet. So that if you think back to the days of the Back to the Land movement in the 70s, that seemed pretty crude and unacceptable for most people. You had to really intensely believe that society was a bad place to want to go back to the land in those, and a lot of people did it. And yeah. And that generation's still living very successfully. But they've now been supplemented by a lot of new technology that has meant that their lifestyle is very similar to the mainstream.
If we continue on the thread of technology, there is this idea out there as well that certain technologies are actually being withheld from us. We can talk about that in terms of patents that have been bought, and there are certain things out there that would hugely benefit not only energy production but other things as well. But we actually are not getting access to them right now because big companies and what have you have actually bought these patents, so they don't come onto the market. Are you guys over at Off Grid looking into this kind of material as well?
I can't say that's one that we've specifically looked at, except possibly, you know, the companies like General Electric and the early days of power, and General Electric own most of the patents for most of things like light bulbs, and of course there could be far more efficient light bulbs than there are. But that's not something we particularly looked at, no.
No. So what about, talk a little bit more about your book, Nick, Off Grid, and some other material that you provide over at the website. Where would you suggest people to go if they're just coming into this and they want to just find out what they can do in their own local area to at least begin to look at some of these ideas? Where do you suggest people to go?
Yeah, well, wherever you are, do come to the Off Grid website. And in fact, in a couple of weeks only, we're going to be launching a new piece of software that will be very efficient at putting people together with other people who want to go off-grid or are interested in looking at that possibility. So I'm sorry that's not quite ready yet, but for the moment, you can come to the website, you can put an ad in the classified section or on one of the forums to say who you are and where you are and what kind of off-grid life you're thinking about, and ask other people in your local area to get in touch with you. And our biggest audience is America, then Britain, and other English-speaking countries. But please do get in touch from Scandinavia or Germany or Spain or France as well. And I think the site is in Spanish and German as well.
Oh, wonderful. So you want people from all over the world to check in on the website and try to build that network, right?
And please use it as a resource. There's a lot of information there about different kinds of solar panels and different people, lots of case studies of people who are doing it and how they're doing it. But most of all, it's a way for you to meet other people who are also interested in the off-grid life and find local people to you, or people with the same problems as you, even if they're not local, and find answers together.
How about propulsion for cars, Nick? You mentioned before that you have alternatives for that. You have a diesel engine, so you can do it on different kinds of vegetable oils and things like that. But we hear about the dawning of the electrical car now, and the question, of course, is, well, great, you can just plug it into your wall and charge it up. But the question is, well, how much will that cost, and where is that energy coming from? Do you see that as a big threat as well? Or what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, there is talk that the electric car, electric vehicles rather, will double the demand for electricity in Western countries over the next 10 or 15 years. So as well as the decline in generating capacity as a result of our outdated generators, there's also going to be an increase in demand. And of course, the answer is very simple. There's no harm in electric cars, for example, but not if the power comes from old smokestack generators and or necessarily from nuclear. I mean, some Greens are now adopting nuclear and saying that it is the answer. Mm. But for me, the nuclear power stations are too big, too centralized, too expensive, too corporate. So I personally don't support big, vast nuclear power stations. Very tiny nuclear power stations is another matter, but they don't exist yet. So to answer your question, electric cars would be fine if they were powered by renewables. But there's not much sign of that at the moment.
Hmm. What about, you know, things like cold fusion? We have other things like what's it called again? The battery cell. There's different kinds of things as well that's on the surface here.
Well, the funny thing is, the old-fashioned lead-acid car battery is probably one of the most ecological forms of energy storage in the world. It's not terribly efficient. You know, they're bulky and so on, but 98% of old-fashioned lead-acid car batteries are recycled, because when your battery dies, of course, it can just be taken back and refurbished, and then it works again as good as new. And the same is not true of the new style.
The lithium batteries.
Lithium, thank you.
Yeah,
those new lithium batteries. They can't be recycled in the same way. The electric cars are going to have very expensive batteries in them, costing up to $10,000. And the business model they're planning is that you'll lease your battery. You'll pay a certain amount each week or each month for your battery, and then it'll go back to base where it can't be recycled in quite the same way, but it can be stripped down and the materials used again.
Hmm.
Fuel cells are a very interesting technology, because they allow you to store renewable energy at the time you make it and then use it later. Because at the moment, one of the problems with wind and solar is that batteries are inefficient, and so on a household level or a local community level, you've only got the energy at the time when it's produced. You haven't really got it when you need it, which is, let's say, at night, when there's, let's say, not much wind and no sun. So everything does depend upon storage, and fuel cells and hydrogen storage does look like the way forward at the moment.
You mentioned one thing there, which I think I want to ask you about that, because we seem to look for one single answer to these questions. What's the best way? And that's what we go with. But what about the idea that we're using multiple different technologies? When it's wind, we use the wind. When it's sun, we use the solar. When it's not any of that is available, as you said before, then we can actually go back onto the grid at those times when it's necessary, and keep a multitude of things in place. I guess the only thing that we're lacking here is a kind of an intelligent system, if you will, that is monitoring this, so it knows where to switch over to and in what times of the day and even of the year. Would you think that that's a major solution to this as well, Nick, that we have to have different technologies?
Sure. Well, there's two answers to that question. The first is that, of course, society has now been organized along the lines of the grid. So there's all sorts of, if you look at all our big ancient cities and towns, the capital cities, they're all set up in places that have good natural advantages, so mostly on rivers or on the coast, or places with good communications. Whereas, of course, after the grid came along, it was very easy to build a new town somewhere that had no natural advantages other than it was on a motorway and it had a big power station next to it. So we're now kind of stuck with that heritage. But the fact is that it would be more sensible to go where the natural power was. So, for example, in Scotland, there's a lot of hydropower, and it would make sense to build more homes near where the power is, because that way you don't have to lose a lot of power bringing it from wherever it is actually manufactured. So that's the first part of the answer. The second part of the answer is, yes, of course, it would seem strange at this point to disconnect from the grid just for ideological reasons. And whilst at the same time we should be making the grid much more dependent upon renewables, there's no harm in upgrading it so that it can detect when renewables are in short supply and switch on other forms of power. But, those mechanisms already exist. The power companies are talking about something called the smart grid, but the smart grid is not so smart. I mean, they're talking about having chips in the fridge so that the fridge will turn itself off when the energy is needed elsewhere in the system. But first of all, let's not forget that once once all our appliances can talk to the energy companies, they'll have even more vast amounts of data about us.
That's right.
Secondly, they certainly won't need to pay their huge army of meter readers anymore. So I assume we'll be getting a discount for that. And thirdly, it will put a kind of power into the hands of the power companies that we'd rather keep at a local level. So, for example, it's a time of high consumption. Who's going to decide whether it's the little old lady in Milwaukee who gets that extra unit of power or some big factory down the road?
Yeah.
And certainly when you've got power being priced in that way, it's going to go up in price at times of high demand, and perhaps fluctuate wildly. So the little old lady who can't afford it is going to get penalized, and the power company and the manufacturing company, which might have a rush order in, is just going to outbid her every time. So I don't see the so-called smart grid as being a good social or community solution, although it might look attractive as a technology solution.
Well, it's a very good point, Nick, and I think we can begin to round things up for that time, for this time. But I do want you to mention the title again of your book, of course, the website, so people know where to go, where to find out more information about what you guys are doing, and mention some of your upcoming projects as well then, Nick.
Thank you. Yeah, well, the website is offgrid.net, off-grid.net, and you can go there, or on Amazon you can buy How to Live Off-Grid. And I'm making a documentary now in America about off-grid living and why it's an answer to so many of the political problems that we're confronted with. And the book will be coming out next year from Penguin. Off-Grid America will be coming out next year.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you, Nick. Off-grid.net again is the website. Keep up the great work, Nick, and thank you again for coming on the program.
Thank you very much for asking me. It's kind of you. Bye-bye.
All right, that's our program with Nick Rosen. Thank you for listening. We will be back soon with more radio. John Cale on the Masonic star map of Charleston in South Carolina. Sabina De Vita on electromagnetic pollution. Kyle Hunt on the gods of technology. Michael Tesserin will join us to talk about striking the roots of the problems. Scott Tipps with a Codex Elementarius update. He's returned from the latest Codex meeting in Germany. And Joe Slate will come on the program to talk about psychic vampires, energy predators, and parasites. Sign up for membership, try it out for 3 months, support our effort, and help us grow in new areas. RedIceCreations.com is the website. My thanks to Fredrik and Elizabeth. Take good care, and we will talk more soon.
There's no such thing as a government. It's only people ruling over people. People jerking around people. People lending a hand to people. What part of the system do you play? Who do you oppress? What kind of world are we living in? Yo, what kind of world are we living in? Can I get with my people? Can I sit with my people? Break bread with my people? Move ahead with my people? What kind of world are we living in? Yo, what kind of world are we living in? When every day 7,000 kids are getting locked up. When every day the justice system seems to stay stopped up. When every day they cut them down before they even pop up. When every day you gotta duck before you get shot up. What kind of world are we living in? Spinning in, winning in, sinning in. Let us begin again. Churches are ran like corporations making me holler. Corporations are ran like churches raising the dollar. There's no way out, or is it? Release your doubt and live it. Teach your metaphysics, don't listen to these penitentiary. What kind of world are we living in? Believe in yourself, achieve for yourself, see for yourself, speak for yourself, never weaken yourself, by deceiving yourself, believe in your wealth. Come on, what kind of world are we living in? Yo, what kind of world are we living in? Can I get with my people? Can I sit with my people? Break bread with my people? Move ahead with my people? What kind of world are we living out? We move about in fear and doubt, trying to get more clout. Just check it out. We took the wrong route to a morality drought. Basically, I'm calling them out. What kind of world are we living on? When it's on, we'll knock it on. Unless it talks about phones. Now, where did we go wrong? We don't have long, but for us all torn, all born, not norm and all gone. What kind of world do we live around? When we lay around, let me break it down. They shutting us down while we play around. We ballin', stallin', while God's calling all in to fall in. What kind of world are we living in? Yo, what kind of world are we living in? Ha, can I get with my people? Can I sit with my people? Break bread with my people? Move ahead with my people? What kind of world are we living in? Yes, what kind of world are we living in? Ha,
thoughts in pregnancy end. When every day another person is betrayed by a friend. When every day it never ends and the people pretend like the president is there because of them. Let me ask, what kind of world can we really trust? When the cops take a shoot at us, what kind of world can we really throw? Oh, when our daughters want to be hoes. People, break bread with my people, move the hell with my people. Can I sit with my people? Can I get with my people?